think one of the things that is most overlooked when it comes to wedges is we actually play the most amount of wedge shots from the rough. So that's one thing, one place that most of us will never even take a wedge when we're testing it over to the rough and look at which ones get through the rough a little bit better. I mean, you'll both played enough golf in Florida to know that when you get to Bermuda, that's a whole different beast. You know, and you go to these little sort of climates, these different little climates, and they're so nuanced. Yet that's why I talk about, you know, your golf clubs are it's almost like a, you know, a soccer team that has 11 players, but you've got another six on the bench.
This is the Tournament Code.
Ian, thank you for joining us today at the Tournament Code. We are sponsored by Puttview Books. They help us keep the lights on, and we like to start every episode with a trivia question. It's just kind of an icebreaker, and this one is U.S. Open-themed, as we are recording the day after J.J. Spahn's pretty cool win at Oakmont. So since Tiger Woods, who are the last two U.S. Open champions to also win a U.S. amateur?
They've won U.S.
Multiple U.S. Okay, he turned yes, pretty quick.
Yes, won the U.S.
U.S. Fitzpatrick.
Fitzpatrick is one. Pretty cool that he won at the same golf course, and there's another one. It's probably going to be obvious when I say it, but it's like all these things, you kind of forget about it. You just forget that these guys did other things.
Oh, I got it. It's Bryson.
Bryson. He won at, I believe it was Olympia Fields. He won the USAM in 15 or 16.
Do you know, I actually didn't remember that he had won the AM, so I would have struggled with that one. But I remember Fitzpatrick pretty well.
And Fitzpatrick was cool because he actually won on the same golf course, the AM and Open. I feel like he should be the honorary pro out there. Spieth was
that's a cool trivia one though.
Spieth was a great guest too because he won multiple juniors, but he never.
He never stayed amateur long enough, really, did he, to play that?
And the interesting thing about Spieth and JT is I'm not sure either of them actually made runs at the USAM. They just had great runs at the junior. I don't know if they did it at the USAM level, but
they were both national champions.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
Gosh, looking back on that, Spieth had a national championship in college, a U.S. Junior, U.S. Open, Masters, British Open. It's pretty crazy. It's a pretty crazy, like, 5-year run for that guy.
It's the amazing thing with tournament players, isn't it? And we sometimes look at it in football, soccer, right? And you look at Lamine Yamal at Barcelona, right? The prodigy, 17. At 17, he's won the World Cup. He's won European Championships. He's got World Cup coming up. Like by the age of 18, he could have literally won everything there is to win in terms of the major honours in the game, certainly under 20. And it's like, what age do, you know, athletes peak? You know, maybe Spieth peaked a much younger age. Maybe his peak was 5 years ago, you know, when he was contending more than that, maybe.
Absolutely. And we see, I mean, I think with Spieth, that's absolutely true. And to an argument, you could have said that about Rory as he got going. He's kind of had this second wave in his career, but Rory at 22 to 25 had been better than Rory at 31. And it is interesting. Yeah. Like, do you have any insights maybe about from like an elite performance perspective? Why do you think some guys come out on tour and they're almost better? Do you think they almost have like horse blinders on where they're too young and dumbed and to get pressure and nervous and they're just ready to roll?
I think that can be the case. You know, you just come out with so much momentum behind you that, you know, you just see every golf course like, you know, like an opportunity and you don't really, you know, it's like playing a golf course for the first time. Sometimes you don't know where the trouble is. And you know, it takes time when you play the golf course, go, wow, I didn't realize out of bounds over that, you know, over that fence or whatever it may be. So, you know, Padraig Harrington had a really interesting take on this. He said basically every golfer, bar the odd exception, has about an 18-month window at which they will win the majority of the titles, the major titles in their career. He said he had a good career, but if you look at the concentrated portion of time that he won his majors, it was within 18 months. And he said, look at Jordan Spieth. Other than really Birkdale, which was a bit of a kind of, you know, he jumped out the pack to win at Birkdale a little bit, but like he done most of his damage in like an 18 to 24 month period, and then after that has struggled. And he kind of says that's what golf is like for most people. You've got a small window where you've got it, and outside of that, you're kind of just fighting for the scraps a little bit. You've got the exceptions like Tiger, and you know Rory's kind of having a little bit of a, well, we'll see if he has a double career, because you know it doesn't look good from post Masters, does it? Like he looks like he's really struggling to deal with whatever, you know, that kind of hurdle was to overcome. But yeah, psychologically, tournament golf, and obviously I can't wait to get into that with you guys, is just a whole different beast, isn't it?
It is. No, I mean, we were talking about, me and Jack talking earlier about Rory, we were just saying, like, it's actually pretty unreal that he finished top 20, unmotivated, playing like crap, just saying that he wanted to get, like, he's like, oh, well, like, I just want to get my quick rounds in and get the hell out of here. And he goes and shoots 67 at Oakmont, which was obviously impressive. I'd like to get into, Ian, what's your expertise is specifically. I understand that you are a master club fitter and you've been a part of an organization called TXG. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you got into that specific part of the game?
For me, equipment was always the thing I was most passionate about golf. You know, I turned pro when I was about 19, went through the PGA system in the UK, got qualified as a Class A, you know, pro by the time I was 22. And kind of you've got that decision, you know, to make what path do you take in golf at that point. You've got kind of your apprenticeship under your belt. Do you go and try and be a head pro? And that didn't appeal to me at all. Quite like the teaching side of things. I enjoyed working with people one-on-one. But what really got me the most was equipment and the differences you could make to help people with equipment. So just working at my local club, I got to know the local reps, and TaylorMade had actually reached out and I think realized that I was, you know, pretty decent with the equipment side of things, and they offered me a job back in 2004. So I went to work for them in the UK, based around sort of various events in UK and Europe. And then sort of that led to, in 2011, kind of reached a point where I went, you know what, this whole working for one brand thing, it's not best for me and it's not best for the golfer either. There's more to this, being brand agnostic, you know, being a free agent, there's more to offer. And I'd be at, you know, demo days where every vendor was on the driving range and people would come to me and ask, okay, I'm looking for the, you know, your best forged irons. And at the time when TaylorMade had R7 and R9, they didn't have any forged irons, never mind good ones. So I'd send them to Mizuno, I'd send them to Titleist, and I'd kind of have that agnostic mindset of, no, they make the best stuff in that category, that's where you need to go. And that just, my mind just sort of, you know, switched in thinking about, you know, what is best for the golfer. So 2011, I got an opportunity from a private investment group to move to Canada to start a company over here called Modern Golf. And there was a really interesting group of people. Probably if I mention some names, you guys would be very familiar with some of the names who actually were part of that original company. So out of that company, have you guys heard of TruSpec Golf? Have you guys heard of them? Yeah. College of Vernon. So TruSpec was basically my idea. So we came up with the name and True. So the idea being that we find the true specifications of golf clubs is what we were doing at Modern Golf. And there was a little group of us that were going to go off and start TruSpec Golf. And, you know, two of the boys did, and I ended up staying in Canada to run the Modern Golf sort of thing. So a few other guys, Ryan Barath, I'm not sure if you know Ryan, who kind of contributes quite a lot to the equipment side of things. He works for Scratch Golf. He worked for Golf WRX, that type of thing. So there was a bunch of people who started within that business, and we've all broke off to do our own thing. And my break off was starting a company called TXG, Tour Experience Golf. So the idea of that was to give the average golfer the same experience that tour players get. So we had I had worked with tour players. I had worked with, you know, players at all levels of the game, European Tour, PGA Tour, and beginner golfers. I'd literally worked with all of them. So the idea with that company was that we were just bringing the tour experience to the average golfer. So TXG, thankfully, you know, took off and went really, really well for us. We had a really strong business. We were eventually bought out by Club Champion in 2021, December 2021, which was something that I really never, you know, never foreseen in the tea leaves of when I started the company. I didn't think, you know, that we would be building something to sell it. That was a little bit of probably my business naivety at the time. You know, I thought we would start this company, we'd fit golfers and, you know, we'd go out to sell a lot of golf clubs. I never really started it with this vision of selling it. We started a YouTube channel that kind of popped and you know, got quite well known in the equipment space. We grew that to just shy of 250,000 followers online, which was a decent sort of size audience. And yeah, we became a bit of a voice in the equipment space. And off the back of that, now subsequently starting Fraser Golf Institute, which is a little bit more of a holistic view of how do we help golfers rather than just funneling them through, you know, the equipment or the teaching side of things. What does it take to be sort of a well-rounded golfer and what attributes do you need? And that's what we focus on at the Golf Institute.
No, that's a great story. I love hearing about all that. And I want to get into Fraser Institute and the holistic approach. First, I just want to zone in on TXG and just wondering, like, what was the normal club fitting experience back then? And what did you guys provide that, you know, may or may not be commonplace today?
Well, I mean, the equipment space has exploded, hasn't it? The aftermarket shaft world, the options that players have. I think for a tournament golfer, any golfer, but, you know, even a tournament golfer, it's quite daunting when you go in and walk in. We would have a shaft wall of 450 shafts, something like that. You walk into that environment and you go, how do I ever sort of decide, or how do I ever get to the conclusion of which one of these is the right? I can't hit them all. You know, we're never going to have enough energy to hit them all. So really, the players who came in our place were at the disposal of the quality of the fitter. And that's ultimately what it comes down to at the end of the day in club fitting. You can buy TrackMan, you can buy GC Quad, you can buy, you know, as many Ventus as you want and stick them on your wall. You know, you can't buy the skill set that it takes to fit someone to the perfect set of clubs for them, or the not even a set of clubs. You know, I don't look at golf clubs like you should have 14. I think you should probably have 18 to 20 that you have within your rotation. I think you should have multiple lob wedges. I think you should have multiple second club options, whether you're 3-wood, whether you're 4-wood, whether you're mini driver. You know, I think that's another part of the game that's involved. So, you know, we were singularly focused at THG on equipment and optimizing that for the player's performance. And I think we were doing that with a knowledge and depth of knowledge that really didn't openly exist in the market.
So I found a quote here, and I think it's interesting. I think you say that you should never buy a golf club off the shelf. Is that correct?
It makes me sick when people do it, honestly.
Just go into the Dick's Sporting Goods and get, you know, the newest driver 460 head and just give it a rip. What's your best practical advice for a golfer who's, you know, they're walking into a store and there's, you know, equipment everywhere. They're following these blogs or Instagrams and YouTubes and there's almost information overload. How should they go getting professionally fit and, you know, reaching their potential with equipment?
It's getting easier, Jack. It's getting much easier. I think a few years ago prior, I would say, honestly, like a little bit, it's probably the reason our YouTube channel done well is because people didn't know these things. People didn't know that when you buy a TaylorMade driver, you've got a loft sleeve that moves not only face angle, lie angle and loft simultaneously, then you get a Titleist one that you can move lie angle and loft independently. There's single axis loft sleeves and there's dual axis loft sleeves. People don't know that type of thing, and neither they should, right? That's kind of, we're the mechanics of the golf industry. We work with the equipment. We will, you know, make sure your equipment is tuned effectively and maximize the horsepower of your golf clubs and effectiveness. There's way more detail to it than sort of people, you know, ever imagined. Cooper, you said something at the start, and it's not a knock, but there's a term in club fitting called master club fitter.
And that, oh, I see, yeah.
Right, and it probably is, like, and you guys will know it because you walk into Dick's Sporting Goods and PJ Superstore, right, and the kid who gives you his business card, it says on it, doesn't it, master club fitter?
Right. Like, yeah, I guess that just stuck in my head because totally. They say it so much.
Yeah, yeah. Like club champion. Everyone, like, yeah, you can right, you can do your 2-week right. apprenticeship at club champion.
Right.
And then they'll give you a designation of master club fitter.
Yeah.
You haven't right. mastered how to tie your shoes in 2 weeks. Never mind how to yeah. fit golf clubs. So for me,
yeah.
you know, the title of anything other than, you know, club fitter is earned over a period of time. And I feel like that's something when people start with us in you know, our training processes and the people they have around them, you accumulate so much knowledge at such a rate that, yeah, you might acquire the sort of ability to call yourself a master fitter in maybe 8 to 10 years. But like, I wouldn't say within the first 10 years, I was a master club fitter. I think I've gotten to a good point now where I'd feel pretty comfortable in any conversation, any environment in the world, whether I'm talking on a stage at the PGA show with Chris Como and Paul Wood and Eric Henriksen and all the PhDs. Yeah, if we're talking golf clubs, I'm holding my own, you know, in any of those conversations, no problem at all. I think it's not until you get to that level where you know, conversations don't go over your head. You know, Bob Volke's a master, right? You know, those people have earned their rights. You know, he spent time with Trevino and Seve. He has mastered the craft of making golf, you know, golf clubs, wedges specifically. You have to earn that title.
So, yeah, so you were talking about wedges, and this made me think this spring I got fit for clubs, I got fit for irons and woods, but I didn't get fit for wedges. And I also heard you say earlier that players should carry multiple lob wedges. What would be your recommendation for me? I'm probably going to buy new wedges pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, wedges are one of the most important for a few different reasons. Obviously, we use them an awful lot. I mean, so much of the game is played inside, you know, 100 yards, especially the level you play at. The competitive advantage of having control when we're talking about proximity to the hole, you know, never mind the nuance of finding the right bounce for you, the right turf interactions, the right sole interaction. So yeah, I mean, there's so many options now that just the chance of finding the right wedges for you just off the rack, just going in and picking up, you know, a 50 08 F grind and a 56 10 M grind. You know, it's just, it used to just be there was wedges and then we would adapt our sort of delivery and technique to adapt to the club. But nowadays we know so much about what an optimized wedge shot looks like. We know that an optimized wedge shot lives around the third groove on the wedge. So the amount of bounce we have in order to control vertical strike height is obviously crucial. Having versatility within your wedges so that, you know, you can maximize how you play from the turf and how you play from the sand. I think one of the things that is most overlooked when it comes to wedges is we actually play the most amount of wedge shots from the rough. So that's one thing, one place that most of us will never even take a wedge when we're testing it over to the rough and look at which ones get through the rough a little bit better. I mean, you've both played enough golf in Florida to know that when you get to Bermuda, that's a whole different beast. You know, and you go to these little sort of climates, these different little climates, and they're so nuanced. Yet that's why I talk about, you know, your golf clubs are it's almost like a, you know, a soccer team that has 11 players, but you've got another 6 on the bench that in certain circumstances, you need to tag one in and tag one out. The golf clubs, your golf set should be that way. You should probably have 2 or 3 different lob wedges. You know, one that is maybe like a D grind that has higher bounce with a little trail and then toe and heel relief. Maybe one that's more like an A grind, which is a version of the popular M grind, but it just has the sort of the high edges ground off of the sole. So there's so much nuance to it, Cooper, that you just... The likelihood of finding the right ones just by buying them off the rack, it's really, really difficult. And then the part two to that is the more loft we use, the more the lie angle impacts the direction of the golf ball. So if we say, let's take, you know, so we're doing podcasts, so most people will be listening to this, but think of just taking a golf club face with 0 degrees of loft, right? We tilt something with 0 degrees of loft, tilt it up, and we tilt it down. we're not really tilting anything. We're changing the face angle, but we're not changing the direction that it points. If we tilt that face with 60 degrees aloft on it and we tilt the toe up, that face points way left. And we tilt the toe down, the face now points way to the right. So the more sort of loft we have, and that is our wedges, the more important the lie angle and obviously the fitting is, that it's going to help you with the direction that your golf ball flies. So something that people don't even take into consideration when it comes to wedges.
Say I have two different wedges with two different types of grinds on them. For what reason would I change to one or the other?
Turf conditions. Could be turf, could be sand. You know, you go over to the Open Championship and, you know, you see the guys, the busiest guy at the Open Championship every single year is Aaron Dill from Titleist. I mean, AD has smoke coming off his shoes when he's at the Open Championship because he's working with so many players. He's taking T grinds and L grinds and the lowest bounce, 4 degrees of bounce, and he's even shaving more off of that for guys. But he, at the same time, he's still trying to give them something. So he needs to give them a wedge that's great on that firm seaside turf. But the difficulty is any bunkers that you get into on the open rota are so heavy and so the sand is so soft. So you need to be able to fight both battles. And so from that standpoint, it's just versatility of turf and conditions.
Sorry, I had a recent experience where my little brother was playing in the US Open sectional qualifier 2 weeks ago, and I was caddying for him. And so we got paired up with two Korn Ferry guys, Dalton Armstrong and Cole Hammer. And these guys were, you know, playing pretty solid golf, hitting it really, really good off the tee, but they weren't necessarily bombing it. And I haven't been around a lot of tour players compared to some people, but I've been around a decent amount. And it seems like every single time I am around a tour player, I'm somewhat surprised that they're not bombing it 350 down the middle. But they're hitting it dead straight. When these guys are getting fit with their driver, how much do you think they're paying attention to absolutely just smashing it? And how much do you think they're paying, or how much do you think they're paying attention to just give me something that goes 280, 290 down the middle? I'm not going to go all out. Because I think it just goes a little bit against the narrative that people say, like, these guys are just absolutely sinning it every time. And I just haven't seen that when I've been around them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it can be surprising. I mean, obviously, YouTube golf is really, really popping pretty hard right now. And I think when you see some of the YouTubers go and play with the tour pros, and then you see when, you know, some of these YouTubers who are decent golfers, but they're probably like, the majority of them are probably 3 handicap, something like that. They're certainly not in the plus. Yeah, maybe something like that. You know, Grant is obviously an exceptional player and he, you know, he's the pinnacle of the whole thing. But, you know, you look at like Rick Shields, you're great, you know, good player, great guy. But like Rick will tell you, like he's as prone to shoot in the high 70s as he is in the low 70s. So I think, you know, when you play with these guys, yeah, it might surprise you that they're not always looking for optimized numbers in terms of a launch monitor. And I think that's a learning that every golfer can take. Don't try to just please the launch monitor, right? These guys generally have quite a lot of speed left in the locker. You know, I was working with Gary Woodland a few years ago and, you know, he just came back off a plane in the Open Championship and at Royal Birkdale. And he was kind of like, just the US, the Open Championship, just it messes with your golf swing, doesn't it? So windy, you're always on your left side trying to flight it, you know, and you come back to the US, to the PGA Tour, and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to kind of adapt to that. And one thing that we saw, you know, with him was, you know, he had so many gears. You know, he could be 178 ball speed, but he could then turn that to 188 ball speed. So, you know, I think these guys do leave quite a lot in the locker at times, you know, just to be functional rather than optimal. And I think that's a really good mode to play, you know, golf in. So, yeah, that's, you know, the speed differential between the average golfer who swing their six, they swing, the average golfer will swing a 6-iron about probably 82 miles an hour, but driver may only go up to about 92 miles an hour. I think average right now is about 94, but let's call it their window is about 10 miles an hour between 6 iron and driver. The average tour pro can stretch that speed between 6 iron and driver out by 25 miles an hour. So that's just the gears that tour pros have that the average golfer doesn't have, and all comes back to, kinematic sequence. They have the ability to push on their sequence and movement patterns to get excessive amounts of speed.
Yeah, I remember there was one hole. It was our 35th hole of the day, and it was a drivable par four. It's about 320, and both of those guys made a swing that I hadn't seen them make all day, and it pushed them up on the green. And I'm like, "Well, where was that all day?" They were, I guess, they're just so skilled that they have all these different types of shots off the tee.
100%.
But no, that was just a really cool experience. So let's go into your Fraser Golf Institute, and I'd just like to learn a little bit more about that. What are the things that you work on with players? Obviously, you bring your club fitting expertise, but I'm assuming that you just kind of wanted to help them more with everything that you know. And what are the ways that you're doing that?
The nature of golf is that you need to be so well-rounded to be, to be a good golfer. You can be physically capable, but mentally, you can have some difficulties with this game, and you'll never make it. I mean, I was thinking about it this morning, just on the mental versus physical side of things. If you put Robert McIntyre on a driving range or on the golf course, and you paired him with Adam Scott, and you took somebody who didn't know golf, and you just watch those two guys, you'd be like, well, the Adam Scott guy is that he must be the best player of those two. Yet you put them in the final round of the US Open with 9 holes to go, and at the
Beaten
minute
by
one,
11.
11, 11, right? So one guy takes that environment and thrives in it, like he walks towards the fire. And then there's one guy who gets in that environment, and it kind of, I don't want to say falls apart, but it becomes, much more challenging for that player, and obviously in Adam Scott, because he has some of that scar tissue, and for whatever reason his game doesn't hold up the same way. So there's so many layers to the game of golf, and that's what the Fraser Golf Institute. So we built it off of 6 pillars, and you're going to test me now, Cooper, to try and remember them all. But
I've got them if you want me to go
so
through
we've
them.
got you got Jackson, that's okay. I should be able to get through it. So we've obviously got the mental side of the game, like we talked about. We've got the practice side of the game, which obviously how people practice, I think, is people are so inefficient in how they practice. They'll go to the range with a bucket of balls and call that practice. Well, you got golf exercise. You didn't necessarily get, something that's going to enhance your game the next time you go to the golf course. So you've got the mental side, you've got practice, you've got strategy, we've got lifestyle and kind of fitness. I think that's a huge part. I'd love to come back and talk a little bit about that. We've got the technology side of things as well. There's so much technology out there nowadays for people, whether it's practicing with GC Quad and TrackMan, whether it's using things like Arcos or to try and track your data. And Jack, I might need you for the last one. What's the last one on there?
Biomechanics,
Biomechanics, so golf swing, basically.
and for those of listeners listening at home, you can check this out at the Fraser Golf Institute. The 6 pillars are golf technology, practice, strategy, fitness and lifestyle, mental and biomechanics. Ian, I guess to get into fitness and lifestyle, I'm sure that's changed a lot in your 20 years of being out and seeing elite players at the most. What are your kind of experiences in the trend there amongst elite golfers, and why you have it as a pillar of like success at your new venture?
I mean, honestly, Jack, I would say it's a big part of the institute, because obviously we want golfers to take care of themselves for golf, but bigger than that, I want people to take care of themselves for their life. I want people to, when they get to the golf course, they're not dealing with injuries, or they're not dealing with bad habits and within lifestyle, whether that's diet, whether that's poor sleep, whatever that may be. But we're living in this era. I think we truly are in this wellness era. I mean, you can't be on Instagram without being told what supplements you need to take, or what sort of technology you need to use in order to sort of be a more healthy and live a more healthy lifestyle. I saw a thing last night about Gen Z, and I think the amount of money being spent on alcohol has dropped from $23 billion from millennials to Gen Z is now spending $3 billion. I mean, the drop in alcohol consumption is through the roof, and that's just because people are so much more conscious nowadays of living a more healthy, you know, healthy lifestyle. And yeah, as much as I care about that for golf, I just care about that for general overall life. I want people to just to be more healthy overall. But when we're talking about golf, there's so many things. Like if you're like, I just found recently, right? I would never have known this. I'm highly allergic to chicken, highly allergic to eggs, and highly allergic to casein, which is the protein in dairy. My diet consisted, the major protein source I would eat for 30, no, for 40 and a half years was chicken. And I would probably have 15, at least 12 to 15 eggs a week. I would have omelets and I'd have eggs and amongst other stuff. So, you know, we can be doing things that lead us into this, just living in a highly inflammatory state by our diet choices, our you know, beverage choices, whatever that may be. And we just don't give ourselves a chance to live a healthy lifestyle. So, you know, I just want people to live, you know, I can see you've got Father's Day blowing behind you, right? Like for you, I want you and me, I'm a dad of two young ones. Like I need to be the healthiest, best version of me because those little ones rely on me to have as much energy as I can to be with them, right? So that to me is a responsibility that it means I have to get the right sleep. It means I have to eat the right food. That's bigger than golf. That's for those two little ones. And that means so much more. So I just think, you know, living a healthy lifestyle is super important.
And it's interesting too. It definitely seems like a lot of tour players are addressing their diet. I think 2 years ago, JT did like a pretty extreme, like no gluten, like no dairy. He might've gone a little overboard, but he probably got in great shape. It just, he might've gone totally over the edge where he was like not having fun with it and it became kind of miserable.
Yeah, no, I have some insight in that. And he absolutely did, you know, he came off gluten. He came off like it was ice cream. You know, he would have a lot of ice cream and stuff like that. And like we all do and have done at various times. And that's the thing with elimination diets. And when you clean up, it doesn't mean that you can never have pizza again or ice cream again. But, you know, your system and your digestive system and your gut, it will need a break from time to time if you're overdoing all that sort of stuff. So what I should probably do, it's been probably 10 weeks since I've done my inflammation test and I got my results back. You know, I think personally, you know, that chicken, eggs, casein were highest on the list of inflammatory foods for me because it's what I consume the most. So I don't necessarily, I want to do it now because I haven't eaten chicken in 10 weeks. I haven't had eggs basically in the best part of 10 weeks. So I think when I redo that, I probably think that those foods will have dropped down the inflammation list a little bit. So, yeah, you walk that fine line between enjoy your life, right? We've got X amount of years on this planet, you know, to spend time with our loved ones. Let's do it and have fun doing it and absolutely make the most of it. But let's not do it where we're causing ourselves to be chronically ill at the same time. None of us want this thing to finish earlier than it needs to. And sometimes we can self-sabotage a little bit on that and make choices and things over a prolonged period of time. It's not the odd slice of pizza that kills you. It's the relentless fast food eating and choices and never really giving your gut a chance. You know, it's 80-20, I believe, Jack, when it comes to diet. You know, if you eat well 80% of the time, you give yourself 20% of the time an allowance to eat the stuff that you just enjoy.
Yeah, and thanks for that insight. I guess now, so you're onto a new venture this year with the Fraser Golf Institute. We've talked on your pillars, especially fitness and lifestyle. If you're comfortable talking about it, what made you want to leave, you know, TXG and Club Champion to go on your own venture? And what do you think you can offer the golf space in this new venture versus what you were doing beforehand?
You know, equipment, it will always be my passion, right? But, you know, if we look at the, well, obviously the business was no longer mine at TXG. Club Champion owned that. So there was I still worked there for 3 years, and it was okay, but it wasn't for me. I knew that working within a corporate environment was not for me. There was some things that mean a lot to me that we didn't share values on, and it came to a point where there was there's always going to be a deal breaker there at some point where you just can't get over a choice that they might make that I would not make, or vice versa. So I knew I had to get out of that space. From the YouTube side of things, that we had obviously gotten so much feedback with from people as to what they struggle with in their own games, and we just leaned into that a little bit. People would ask us so many other questions other than just about equipment, and we would have times where we strayed from the TXG YouTube channel into more of the biomechanics side of things, or the golf swing side of things, or the golf performance side of things. And our audience really, really loved it. They would certainly embrace that we would not just talk equipment all the time. So after making probably 1,300 YouTube videos on golf equipment, and it was probably somewhere in that window over the 18 years we were doing it, I mean, we made so many golf videos. I kind of felt like more club reviews. There's so many people doing club reviews now. I don't think that's what our audience really were looking for, was more of the same. Now, I'm not saying that I won't be back doing club reviews and equipment at some point. I absolutely will. But right now, I'm getting a lot of fulfillment myself personally from doing stuff outside of that. We talked at the start about, mastery and how long it takes to become a master at anything. I really probably wasn't learning as much as I liked about equipment. I probably reached a bit of a point where I wasn't really continuing to learn much more. Whereas in the side of things I'm in now with the Fraser Golf Institute, I'll talk to biomechanists, I'll talk to people like you guys who had the podcast guys, like I'll interact with Scott Fawcett or Lou Stagner, or guys like that. And I learn a lot from those guys because it's just I'm coming at it from such a different angle. So I'm really enjoying that side of things as well.
Do you have plans to continue making content with the new side of things that you're working with?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, content will whatever I do moving forward in the golf space, content will be a huge, huge part of it. I just look at the world now and how we're sort of making our choices, and I think so scheduled network TV is pretty much gone for the most part. I think we're all consuming content on demand. And when we started the TXG YouTube channel, I actually wanted to call it TXG TV because I wanted people who love the golf equipment to be able to basically turn on the TXG YouTube channel and be able to kind of watch either the fittings that were going on in the bay, or maybe a review of the ping drive or tailwind drive, whatever it may be, and have content on demand when it came to golf equipment. And it's just something I'm, again, passionate about. And I just think that's the way people are consuming golf content nowadays. So if we can connect with people all over the world, not just within a region, then YouTube is probably the best platform for us to do that on.
You guys have great content over the year and just built a pretty sustainable brand over a very long period of time. And I think you definitely have earned the right to call yourself a master. Could you, to circle this back and kind of land the plane here, could you talk about like the 20 years you've spent in the golf equipment space? What's been the biggest change you think from today back to when you first started, and just where the market's kind of going?
I think the two biggest changes in the game in recent time, I think the golf ball changing to be a solid core golf ball was a huge change. I think that changed how we were able to optimize ball flight. I think being able to sort of create, we know high launch, low spin, if the driver is desirable, that was really hard to achieve with the old technology. And I think the golf ball revolutionized that. And then obviously technology now that we, obviously TrackMan came in and changed the game, even explaining to instructors that really you want two golf swings. You want the golf swing that is optimized when the ball is in the air, and then you have the golf swing that's optimized when the ball's on the ground. And I think that changed the face of coaching for so many people to know that we kind of swing up and right with the driver, we swing down and left with the irons. You know, I don't think that was kind of really being taught that well. And now looking at things like motion capture or force plates and stuff like that. So, you know, I think technology, we're in the technology age and era, obviously driven largely by machine learning and sort of data capture through AI now, that we are just getting so, the quality of the data is just off the charts nowadays, you know, so that we can take people's unique blueprint. And now we don't have to change their golf swings, and we don't have to, you know, try and put them on a V1 video software side by side with Adam Scott and say, look, you know, Jack, you're not at the top of your swing. You're not like Adam Scott. Well, you know, no shit. Who is? You know, nobody is. So, but that doesn't mean you can't play the game. Back to a Robert McIntyre sort of comparison, it doesn't mean you can't play the game at high level just because your golf swing doesn't look a certain way. But now we're looking at things that are much more sort of important, like force patterns on swing catalyst or smart to move. And we, you know, you might look at a swing that's more aesthetically pleasing, but it's not as functional as a golf swing that looks less so. But now we're starting to see things that are giving us more information as to what actually works on the golf course.
I actually heard something a couple days ago, and somebody was teaching, I believe it was Nelly Korda, and she hadn't used a TrackMan, and he got her started on a TrackMan, and all she focused on were like three tiles. It was face to path, and like launch angle. And that was the season that she took off. And I think it can be information overload, especially with everything that's out there. We see it in the equipment fitting space, but even on the driving range at a tour event with TrackMan, guys have 27 tiles beeping at them that you can't make sense of that amount of information.
No,
it's just, no. It's insane. And I guess what advice would you give to say a Korn Ferry Tour player comes to you looking to get professionally fit? Like, I mean, obviously they have a lot of golfing talent. They're probably associated with some brand, but you're going to be brand agnostic and get them the best stuff. How would you go about that and get them the best possible setup through fitting?
You know, I think it's just building that relationship. One sort of thing I've always talked about with regards to club fitting is that club fitters are not looked upon in the same way as golf instructors. Golfers and golf instructors build a relationship. They work with each other over a period of time, and you know they'll end up working towards an end goal. Working with a club fitter tends to be much more transactional and much more of a once-off type of thing. So I would love for us to get to a point in club fitting where we're building relationships over a long period of time, where you know, with our Korn Ferry example of, we're going to fit someone into some clubs, and then we're going to let that play out. We're going to, you know, get some data on how is that performing. I think one of the things that is not done well enough in the club fit environment, Jack, is how do we stress test, right? Because there's one thing being on a launch monitor and getting optimized numbers, but there's a completely different thing is when you put someone in an uncomfortable environment, what happens? Generally, you can then understand how it breaks down. That's what matters to us. How does it break down under pressure and stress? And then ultimately, then we can get the answers to the problems that the golfer's facing. So you're never going to get that from a two-hour club fitting session. And that's why I always seek, or you know, recommend people seek out a professional, an expert, someone who really knows their stuff, and build a relationship with that person and give them your trust when it comes to obviously building out the set of clubs that you're going to, you know, make your living with.
That's great. And I love what you said about how do you stress test golf clubs? Because I was somebody on the range on TrackMan in a lesson. You would think I was, you know, I could have played professional golf. But when you get, you know, when it matters, when you got to sign a card in a tournament setting, the golf swing deteriorates very, yep, very fast.
I'm the same as you, Jack. I'm exactly the same as you. You know, put me indoors, genuinely. I mean, you know, like indoors and ask me to hit at targets, I can play to a really high level at that discipline. Put me, you know, on a golf course and right now, and that's uncomfortable for me, very uncomfortable for me.
It is. It's dealing. I think the best way to describe golf at a high level is how well do you deal with discomfort? And that probably is more of a differentiator I guess what Cooper was saying about guys where they're not really sending it as much as you think. Well, they're probably a lot better at dealing with pressure than the guy that's hitting it 345 down the middle every time on TrackMan on the range. But when it's go time, it's a little bit different. Now, then there's also some of those guys who pull it off on the PGA Tour and they're complete monsters. And, you know, you kind of turn into Scotty. And when they can do it technically and mentally, you seem to win every week. But I think Cooper has a final question for us, if you want to roll with it, Cooper.
Yeah, we're close to wrap. So I'll just ask you the final question that we ask all of our guests. And for you, it's going to be a two-parter since I know you're helping some kids currently. And the first part is going to be, if you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer, what would you tell yourself? Just one thing, what would you tell yourself? And now, if you could just tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would you tell them?
I would tell the player or the parent to a junior golfer, I would say, you know, build a really strong team around that player. You know, club fitter, coach, golf psychology obviously plays a big part and has its place. I think golf strategy really sort of enhance your golf IQ. On the golf course, I think that's really, really important to develop that. Don't, and the mistake I made on that side of things was to probably try to find all the answers to those questions myself. That was probably the biggest thing. And to be honest, it led me to where I am today. But when I turned pro and I had aspirations to be a tournament player, I then went looking for all the answers that I didn't know all the answers to the questions that I had that I didn't know the answers to. So I would say let other people worry about that and just focus on being an athlete. That's the biggest thing I see from, you know, the golfers that I work with that are really good. They are much more reactional. They're much more instinctive. They focus on getting the ball in the hole in the fewest amount of shots possible. They're not trying to launch the golf ball at 13 and a half and spin it at 2100. That's a byproduct of a process they've went through, not something that they're actively trying to do or seek out. So, you know, I would just, if I was to go and give myself that advice as an 18-year-old, I would have just said, stick to what got you from being a beginner golfer. I took up the game when I was 16 and I turned pro when I was 18 and a half. So 2.5 years to turn pro from a beginner golfer was because I relied on being an athlete. You know, I played football at a high level. I played other sports at a really high level. And I got away from the one thing I was good at, and that was being athletic. So, you know, I'm trying to get back to that now. And, you know, it's really starting to pay off. And I see the value in just being an athlete.
Ian, thank you so much for the time. We really appreciated having you and talking to you about tournament golf. To our listeners and viewers, please like and subscribe. You can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and X at Tournament Code. As always, we enjoyed having you and look forward to diving in deeper as what it takes to play elite tournament golf.